Thank you for tuning in to the Head Game Podcast, powered by Mindful Athlete Training, where you grab an inside look into the heads and minds of the high performer. Learn what they do and how they think to help you take control of your own head game. So welcome back to another edition of Uncut, episode 2, technically, kind of, not really. For the Head Game, my name is Dr. Lee Piccarello, and my cohort for today, my partner, Dr. Hunter Stevens. We were talking a little bit earlier, Hunter, about, I was talking a little bit earlier about a change of season and back to school for all the parents out there. We work with a lot of athletes that are all about transition right now. I think of our quarterbacks that we've been working with that have been prepping the majority of spring, very intense all summer long. And then it's decision time. It's depth chart time. Where do I fall? There's a lot of anticipation. There's a lot of hope. And sometimes there's disappointment. There's frustration. There's not so fast, young man. You need to stand in line a little bit more. And it got me thinking just about the concept of change, specifically disruption. When our plans get disrupted, whether we respond to it with a certain amount of defense and fight, or our first instinct is to shut down and maybe rest or even avoid for a while. What are your thoughts about that?
Excited to have another episode again, just for our listening audience. This is really just a snapshot of kind of where our minds are at as experts in the field, and the people that we're working with. So Uncut is really, and then again, a series to really provide a unique perspective. And so when I think about change, or more so this disruption aspect, you know, I think about, where does my mind traditionally drift to? Where is my mind typically held in place? And disruption typically occurs when you're going about your day and you have a particular expectation for what is going to happen, and then something doesn't, or you have an expectation for the way that, you know, maybe your schedule is going to go, or where a coach is going to put you, or how your teachers are going to respond, or your parents, or your boss, or just how the world is supposed to be going. And then all of a sudden we might come across, you know, a conversation. We might see a grade. We might have an email, a text, a phone call, or even something just we read or see on our phones, especially nowadays, that disrupt what our kind of equilibrium was, because it's our expected equilibrium really that we're trying to lean into. So I think disruption is always going to happen. And it's really about how open and how aware and attuned we are to what we perceive as the expected as well.
I agree with you that, you know, disruption always comes in different shapes and forms, different times in our life. Sometimes we can see them with what I've referred to in the past as a clear line of sight. Mm-hmm. We anticipate disruption. We plan accordingly. Sometimes we pride ourselves in wanting to be more attention to detail oriented. So when that disruption comes, it's not so bad. But this is the thing that I think warrants more attention. For me personally, it's not even so much, Hunter, about the disruption in 2023, but it's the intensity by which people want to respond. And what I mean by that is, it just feels like, and this very easily could go off into a technology-driven conversation, but it feels like information is being thrust at us so aggressively, so consistently, that we are, at least personally, I feel forced to choose a side. And that side has become much more polarizing into the right side or the wrong side. You're either part of solving the problem or you're contributing to the solution. And I just feel that, yes, disruption has been everywhere. When you look at history, there's always been disruption. But it feels like, and again, this might be because I'm smack dab in the middle of it, that the intensity by which we are encouraged to ask continues to rise, that rising tide seems to be floodworthy more days than not.
Yeah. Is that just the very nature of the world, that disruption is going to be there in some capacity? And we talk about the change of seasons you know, obviously here in the Northeast, that is a natural phenomenon, right? That's occurring. I guess it's more so I think about like, what is our tolerance level to that change? Because sometimes a simple change of like, here's an expected change, right? The fall is coming, hopefully it stays here as well. Like that's an expected change, right? So I think there's a little bit more tolerance when there's an expected disruption. I think even a minor disruption, right? Maybe just a small amount of traffic, right? Or something that, you know, didn't necessarily go exactly your way, but you believe that things will eventually turn that way. There's a little bit more tolerance for that. I think when tolerance gets hit, when your level of tolerance gets hit, that's when disruption is really a derailer. But I think right now, as you're talking about information, the flow and the speed in which things are coming, I think it doesn't, it's just surging past most people's tolerance levels because it's just this mental fatigue, because it's this constant bombardment that's not allowing us to really build up either our tolerance because we're not necessarily paying attention to it, or we're meeting our threshold and it's just consistently coming. The dam has overfilled and is overflowing, and we're not stopping that flow because it's just constant one day after another. And I think that disruption is really what is shifting maybe the mindset of individuals more so than ever.
I'm listening to you and I go right back to COVID. I go back to arguably in our lifetime, the most significant disruptor of them all. 14 days to stop or slow the spread. Mm. That was what we were told, mm-hmm. which then we all know turned into 30, 60, 90 days of lockdown.
Yeah.
Unprecedented. But we were asked to forego the common methods by which we cope while enduring the most significant stressor of our lives. Mm-hmm. We couldn't go out. We couldn't exercise. We couldn't socialize. Our kids couldn't go to school. We couldn't go out and do the traditional things. And for that reason, I think the tolerance level of society since that time, since 2020, has not yet recovered. Hmm. It hasn't. We see it every single day in how we do our job. Why we are promoting the proactivity of mental fitness is so drastically needed in today's world, because the reactivity of mental health is failing. It's failing human beings. It's failing society. I almost want to invite the major media moguls to the party because they're so drastically late in the news that they report. Newsflash, child and adolescents are struggling post-COVID with social adaptation. It's as if they're just discovering this now. And I find it concerning because the narrative that needs to be discussed in the face of disruption is one of mental fatigue is so relevant that if we're not contributing almost daily to a proactive method of building mental endurance, it's not if, but when we're going to struggle again.
Yeah, I think about it in the sense, you know, we're always trying to ground it and help people understand it more effectively. And I think the physical world is just much more an effective tool because people can understand that. You grow up PE, right? Learning about the physical world. And not everybody does it. But I think for the most part, there's a general understanding that if you eat in a specific way, right, a little bit more nutritional, right, plant-based overall, you don't only have to eat plants, but plant-based diets are a little bit more effective. If you're restricting calories, right, not completely, you're exercising at least like 20 to 30 minutes a day, like you're going to live a healthier life. Your body is just, it's going to give you the better chance. Now, genetics will always play a factor. I always think about like my wife's grandmother who ate like a fillet of fish every single day and lived to, you know, 90 years old. There's always, if you can take care of yourself and you're proactive in your physical health, like you're just going to live a more fulfilling and a better life. But that's not always the case with mental. And I regularly believe, too, it's the newness of the field and obviously the stigmas that come with it. When I say the newness of the field, you know, the physical, we can think about probably the origination of maybe thought, you know, is the original philosophers of Aristotle, Plato, right? Thinking about, you know, where our mind lies. But really that was lost during kind of the Middle Ages a lot of times and how people were considering their thoughts because they were just more so focused on other aspects. And really, psychology has become a field only really for the past couple, maybe 100, 150 years, really as a way of thinking. And science has kind of helped that. And so I believe that people are underdeveloped for what the demands and tasks are of today, because technology, because of information, because of what is now asked of us at a faster rate, we haven't necessarily fully developed into that space. And the people who are trying to understand that are trying to catch up and create solutions in a way to teach others how to navigate that. And that comes from a proactivity. So I think a lot of people lack an understanding and knowledge and are resigned to the stigma that if my mental isn't where it needs to be, I'm broken and that's not a good thing, versus if my mental isn't where it needs to be, I need to develop it. I need to work on it, which is much more of a physical model.
Is that underdeveloped, though, part of a nature, nurture, genetic environment? Is it learned over time? Is it society that has identified the mental out of ignorance thousands of years ago as the unknown, therefore the inexplicable becomes taboo?
You know, everything I think has a root in its genetic component to some degree. Someone who's going to dunk a basketball, someone who might be 7 foot tall, who has a 7'5" wingspan, is probably going to be easier time dunking, doesn't need to jump as high just through the genetic component alone. But there definitely needs to be that nurture component. I think when it comes to mental, there's definitely a genetic component, right? Some people are more susceptible, as we know. If your family potentially has history of alcoholism, right? There's a little bit more of a susceptibility. If there's a little bit more bipolar in your family history, right? That potentially plays a role in your susceptibility, right? Not causation, but there is sometimes correlations through that. The biggest aspect too, though, is that also the world as it is, right? The environmental cues in which you're kind of engaging with. So tolerance levels, I think, can be set a little bit by genetics, but it can be reinforced through how you engage. So if you have strong, good family ties, secure base, good relationships, that's going to help you tolerate those disruptions maybe a little bit more effectively than if you grew up in an environment that was constantly changing. There was a lot of threat cues. There was a lot of lack of sense of security. You might be less tolerant to navigate those aspects, and you might be more reactive as a result of it.
Now, just the other side of that coin is when we talk about how people respond and what their genetic component might encourage. A genetic predisposition is what you're explaining. I quickly go to, what about the unforeseen event that we'll just call an injury? Very analogous to that of a physical injury.
Yep.
When you look at an Aaron Rodgers, you know, with his Achilles tear, and you look at his mindset and the impact that it's having on the New York Jets organization and the trickle-down effect that it's having through the New York fan base, even the national media, right? The entire city, right? Simply by the unforeseen trauma, we'll call it for the point of this discussion, that is the consummate disruption, because it really is disrupting the mindset of the person who has done the so-called homework, is appropriately prepared, we assume, and has now endured something that was unforeseen. It's only in that response to the disruption that then defines what we call mental strength, right? The ability to withstand pressure or mental recovery. So when I say those things to you and you think about disruption as that event comes, what are your thoughts?
I think that's a great point in terms of thinking about response, because if you haven't necessarily developed a pathway, or you haven't developed a model, or you haven't developed tools to support you, it definitely leaves you more susceptible. But your response is really where you have the most control, because most likely if that disruption you would have foreseen, you probably would have tried to circumvent it in some capacity. You probably would have tried to navigate it. You know, this is something that just probably occurs to some degree. Proactivity is going to help you navigate that more effectively, give you the tools. But it's ultimately down to your response that really will dictate how that disruption plays a less or more significant role in your life. And so I think really it's important to focus on the proactive approach will help you respond more effectively and probably more aligned with what you're wanting. But it's also the notion of expectation that comes along with that.
I go right to, in the response to disruption, even though we can teach or train proactive measures, I think human beings in general struggle with planning for what might happen. Even with all of the education that supports it, even with
are you saying they have a challenge with actually planning, or like that they're constantly planning?
No, I think because we as a human race are trying to manage the best way that we know how, that consumes almost all of our energy. So then to bring on, and I think this is part of the how you manage disruption in your life collectively, which I think for us is our driving point in trying to develop a bigger community of people who are receptive to, invested in the concept of mental fitness. I think most people struggle with, their deck is pretty much full with their day-to-day grind. So this notion of learning something that they might need in anticipation of a stressor, to your very point, if they could foresee the trauma, they would do everything in their possible, we would like to think they would do everything in the possibility to avoid that, to sidestep mm-hmm. that. What I'm speaking of is, do we have the mental capacity as to where we are in 2023 with the influx information, with the ever dominant core messages that seem to get higher and higher around us? Do we have the capacity to say, I'm going to go out and train and do something that I know that will help me if something comes my way that I don't see?
I'm kind of a humanist. Like, I believe in the aspect of like humans. I believe in the capacity can always enhance, and that people are really capable of anything when put or when set in the right path or have the effective information. I mean, we've done some pretty remarkable things, some things that are supportive and also some things that are challenging as well. Do I think we have the capacity? I think there's the capacity to do so, but I think there's a lacking of that availability. You know, we talk about availability a lot. I don't think people are always, as you mentioned, because the proverbial cup is so full, right? If you try to learn something, but your cup is full, you know, you're constantly, it's overflowing. You're never going to be able to actually take in information. And I think people fill their day and fill their lives, and they're so focused on the day-to-day grind, right, that they don't give themselves that time to take that step back, to be more introspective, to look at their mind as something that can be developed. One, because they either don't know how to do that, or there aren't enough voices out there to teach as well effectively and to really train them. So I think people have the capacity, but I think the availability is lacking out there in terms of people's, how can I actually navigate this disruption and be okay with it?
To use your full cup analogy, I go right to, most people are too focused on what the spill might encourage. They're too focused on damage control. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they don't see the total available mental capacity that can be, that high tide can get just a little bit higher. That cup can just get a little bit more. Yeah. I think we struggle to see that because of whether it's fear of failure, whether it's fear of, in today's world, not being accepted, right? Dr. Michael Gervais just released a new book, FOPO, Fear of People's Opinions, not Fear of a Better Option, FOBO, not... it's FOPO. It's fear of other people's opinions. And it's a resounding mm-hmm. message where, if we're that concerned with how other people are interpreting what we do, how we do it, when we do it, then it's going to make, I think, society in general that much more challenging for us to endure and say, you know what, this whole capacity thing is something that I want to work on more as an individual. It's going to benefit me, my loved ones, how I go about my job. There is a certain level of maturation that I think can come along with the education that you and I know is so incredibly important for us to be telling.
to some degree, you can give someone the same exact experience, right? Or that same exact disruption. And just based on their mindset, are they more optimistic or are they more pessimistic individual? You know, just through that very nature, or are they more fearful, right? Or are they more anxious, more prone, more neurotic, right? As a result of that, you know, that's going to dictate that response to them. It's going to dictate how they're going to be viewing that situation, how they're feeling about it, how it's physically affecting them, how it's going to affect their family around them as well, the people that they interact with. And I think right now it feels as though there's this big prop up of anxiety, a prop up of fear. That's really generating things maybe more so than ever, if not just more visible than ever might be a better language instead of more present than ever, because I haven't been around that long, right? So maybe it's just more visible than ever. And I think as a result of it, it's creating this kind of negative spiral around whatever we experience, especially when it's disruptive. But regularly we talk about how stress is information, how it's a tool to learn and to grow. And if you just think about, I'm lacking the information of what this means, we can truly find support. And I think it's important to recognize that we don't know what the outcome is going to be, but we have to kind of navigate that to the best of our ability with the information we have present in the moment.
So I think about tools that we could provide as we continue to, you know, share this stream of consciousness back and forth between the two of us. What tools would you recommend when, say, someone were to come to you and say, you know what, my capacity is about full. I think my cup is just about full. I know that there's something that I could be doing differently. What do you recommend, Doc?
So there's a variety of different things that I can talk about. The first thing is it's not that serious. It's just a statement, I think. It's so what? So what if it is the worst case scenario? What you have to do is then deal with it. You have to navigate it. And it might not be the best, but so what isn't to give up, isn't to be complacent, but it's an effective tool to kind of shift your mindset into, okay, how am I going to respond to this? So a so what mentality isn't a complacency, but it's deal with it and focus on that. Now that's a little harsh. It's not necessarily the most coddling, but I think there's time and place to be coddled. And there's also time where you might need to focus in on, hey, I need to take accountability and actually take action. So that's one of my advice. Probably the other advice that I would always consider too is to take that step back and recognize, hey, I have to look at my kind of overall just life right now. Where are things that are my priorities? Am I engaging in my priorities or am I not? You know, am I assessing my values and actually engaging with them? Or am I really focused on just another day, right? The hours that I'm spending at work? Or am I actually taking that time to get off my phone, you know, take a walk in a park, you know, see my family? You know, am I doing those things? So that's kind of taking a step back at the larger sphere and then taking that accountability with that kind of, so what does this mean? If this is disruptive, so what am I going to do about this? How am I going to adapt? Not the, I should have done something different. How about you?
I always go back to values. You know, I'm very value-laden, value-focused in the advice that I give, taking more personal accountability, taking inventory about what is the most important thing to you. I think we lose sight of that very often as we ebb and flow in and out of stages of life. We're all in different stages of life based on our age, based on our vocational situation, based on interpersonally where we are with friends, family, relationships. We're all in different stages. And I encourage people to do a value-based inventory. You know, ask yourself, I did this exercise years ago for one of my continuing education retreats, and it was in Toronto, which is a phenomenal town, by the way. If you never have been, it's a wonderful global conglomerate of individuals, only about an hour flight from the Philadelphia, New York area. And the message was provided by a military psychologist, and he asked everyone in the audience to write down the most 10 important things in their life. And we were given 5 minutes to do it. And I found it a little difficult, and coming in on number 10 or number 11, and And then we did a quick process and he said, okay, he said, I want you to take 60 seconds and I want you to just eliminate three of them. Cut your list from 10 to 7. And I initially was a bit shocked. Like, you just asked me to give you my top 10. These are absolutely the most 10 important things in my life. And now you want me to cut it to 7. And then after that, we did a quick process. He said, okay, I'm going to give you 30 seconds. I want you to eliminate three more and go from 7 to 4. And there were a lot of huffing and puffing and, oh my God. And the audience was getting a little disgruntled. And he said, just bear with me. Just cut three more. And then again, we did another quick process. And then I think he gave us like 10 seconds. And he said, now I want you to cut three more and go from 4 to 1. And he started counting out loud, 10, 9, 8, right. Just putting the pressure on. And then afterwards, he said something very simple that's always resonated with me. You can always define the most valuable thing in your life if you absolutely have to. And I think for most of us, we get consumed with our lists. We get overwhelmed with the possibility of what to attend to. What's my level of urgency based on this versus that? A shift in priority really is what encourages the mental fatigue component that I think you mentioned earlier in our conversation that continues to build and continues to rise. Now you have the onslaught of media and social media saturation and the platforms that are literally in our face 24/7, constantly challenging, maybe even chipping away at our top 10 list, thus forcing us to feel like you're a juggler, Hunter, you know, to juggle a few more balls, to get them up in the air, right? To hold them up there longer. And I think that that is the root cause of the mental fatigue. And I think the catalyst really for what we're talking about.
Well, yeah, you'll always find more energy if the thing is motivating enough, right? If something is of value enough. It's kind of like those questions like, you know, how far are you willing to go, right, for $1 million kind of thing, right? Or for $5 million or $10 million, right? Once you ante up to some degree, right, that number or whatever that motivation is, people can find that energy. And so when you talk about those things are mental fatiguing, I also feel like when you recognize the things that are valuable effectively, the mental fatigue probably is still there, but it still allows you to continue to move forward. It still gives you that tolerance to deal with the challenges, to be more mindful of how you want to respond and really kind of face that mental fatigue and continue to build that mental endurance to kind of combat that a little bit. So I think values are a really important system to navigate, you know, your fatigue or your obstacle course or your marathon of life that you experience. So I love that exercise and I would love everybody to try that at home.
I am sitting here listening and trying to be an audience member and say to myself, like, what does this sound like? And what additional value might we be able to provide? When we first sat down and talked about the value of what we're calling Uncut, this is it. This exchange between you and I, because we are in very different stages of life, but we also have similar values that we share. But I think the unique perspectives of our back and forth, for me personally, I always say to clients, athletes, corporate execs, the military that I've been fortunate enough to work with, I always say to them, if I myself am not willing to model, to stick my neck out, to disclose to a degree, what my perspective, what my firsthand point of view is, then I can't really ask you to challenge yourself, to take inventory. So I'm sitting here listening to myself and saying, what am I getting out of this conversation? And I think the value for me is because obviously I think you know that I respect your opinion, but in recognizing and appreciating the differences is what keeps me healthy and what keeps me sharp. It assists with my own mental fatigue, Hunter. Because as I listen and as I digest and as I make sense of your opinions, that helps me endure all the other things in life because that's part of my balancing act. And I think that's the value of Uncut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think perspective is always a unique and individualistic experience. And I think being able to share perspective and to discuss and disagree and to navigate perspective is always important as part of it. That'll always play a role, I think, into these uncuts. And I think it's something that people should really pay attention to in their own lives, because perspective really dictates everything, right? As what you say typically is
so
what
true.
We perceive the world, right? However we perceive the world is what we believe the world to be. And so really exploring what your perceptions are and navigating them too. Sometimes those perceptions are not necessarily supportive of the things or your values. And sometimes they are. So try to lean into the ones that maybe are more navigating towards your values and being mindful of the ones that maybe aren't.
What the mind perceives, the body believes.
Yep. Absolutely.
Great talk, man. Good awesome. Topic.
Thanks everyone for listening. Talk to you in the next one.